And as I said, we have a tight schedule, so we're going to move right away to the second presentation by Kim Forss. Hopefully, if time allows, we'll have time in the very end to broaden to questions from the audience. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll talk about two studies here. One about which is about methods and approaches to aid evaluation, and secondly about the quality of CDI evaluations. And I'll start, of course, with the first one. The title of that study was Broadening the Range of Designs and Methods for Impact Evaluation, and that was commissioned by the Department for International Development, the UK aid organization, and it's a working paper for them. We were a team of six people led by Elliot Stern, who worked on it, and you can find the study at www.gov.uk. The background to the study was that in the organizational reforms in DFID, there was an emphasis on improving, sharpening decision-making, making it evidence-based and based on rigorous findings of impact and results in aid. And somehow rigor and evidence is also connected to experimental methods in aid evaluation and RCTs in particular. And that led to challenges for the people in the evaluation unit in moving towards working more with randomized control trials. And of course, they often did so, and DFID is leading, one of the agencies leading in this field today, but they had problems applying it over the whole sphere of development cooperation. Just to mention a few examples that we were given in this study to look at. How do you evaluate these programs? And the basic feeling here was that it would be a bit difficult with experimental methods. So, for example, we have a program here on response to the Haiti earthquake. How do you design an experimental evaluation method for that? How do you go about it? Or if you look at violence against women in Bihar in India, which was a huge program which combined legislative development with interventions with safe houses for women and educational programs in schools, etc. So it would be a bit difficult there too to find an experimental approach to that evaluation. Looking at these different evaluation tasks then that DFID had to deal with, and for us then to think of, well, how do you go about evaluating it? We said, well, the first step is actually to try to nail down the impact question. What is it really DFID needs to be interested in? What do we need to find out from this in the evaluation process? Well, it is, of course, a question of finding out the impact as such, what has happened. But it's also a question of finding out to what extent can the impact be attributed to the intervention, and what difference has the intervention made, and how has the intervention made a difference, and also will the intervention work elsewhere? The reason you want to know about the impact is because you want to address all these questions, most of the time anyway. Now, what do these questions then mean? Well, the first thing is about attribution and contribution, which is about causality. And I'll talk a little bit about causality, because when you come to discuss what designs to choose for an evaluation, it is because the different designs have different assumptions around the causal processes. So causality, because in the classical case, for something to be said to have caused another, it has to be necessary and sufficient. It has to fulfill those criteria. But in reality, you will find that often things can be necessary but not sufficient for the effect to happen, and sometimes sufficient but not necessary. If we take the case of a school building that Anders mentioned, you can say that, well, improved schools could be necessary, but it's probably not sufficient. You probably also need to work with teachers' education, increasing enrollment to schools, etc., to get the impacts. It also happens sometimes when I have evaluated projects, that you find that, well, the project is sufficient for the effect to happen, but maybe not necessary. It could have happened in other ways. And sometimes you find that it's neither necessary nor sufficient, but it's part of something contributing to the change that we see. Now these are the, let's say, the elements of a discussion around causality. In the theory of science today, one talks more actually about causal packages, about how many things have to hang together to produce desired impacts or results. But then we also need to find out exactly how the intervention makes a difference, as you remember the third type of impact question that I addressed here. How and why have the observed impacts come about, and what are the causal factors or mechanisms that have, in combination, resulted in the observed impact, or lack of impact for that matter? It's also very important to find out about unintended effects and how they have come about, and of course how the intervention has made a difference. So it is the how question is often quite important. And will the intervention work elsewhere? In the decision-making processes in aid organizations, you would often want to know whether an intervention shall be continued or whether it should actually be changed or possibly closed down altogether. And you may also want to know whether you can apply what you have learned from an intervention in Tanzania, in neighboring Zambia, or whatever the case may be. But to take those decisions, you would, of course, want to know exactly how does it work, and then what are the different constraints? Can the mechanism be changed in some way or the other, and how does context play into it? It also often happens when you do impact evaluations that you find that the impact is very low or negligible or in fact even negative at times. And then you would want to know why has that happened. You would probably not be satisfied with the response that the impact has been low or none or negative. And what is the contribution that the impact has made. Now, I mean, so far we haven't really come to see what are the alternatives to experimental methods. And before we get there, I would like to point to a few more distinctions here, and that is the distinction between designs and methods. As you know, I've noticed I talk about designs, not about methods so far. Design refers to then the overarching logic of how research is conducted. It's about the research questions, the theory you apply, the data, and the use of data in the analytical process. Now, different designs may share the same methods. For example, if you do a randomized control trial or a case study, you can still work with interviews or surveys or whatever. So these are separate issues. Most of the methodological discussions that you see in evaluation reports are about the choice of methods, whether you do interviews or work with quantitative data or something else. They are not discussions around design. But design is the most important discussion because it is through the design that you start approaching how will you draw conclusions around causality and what are the assumptions around causality through the different designs. It is, of course, obvious to distinguish evaluation and research, but a point that we make in this particular report is that impact evaluation is inevitably pushed towards the norms and principles of scientific research. Now, what are then the different design approaches? It's very difficult to actually classify approaches and designs in neat categories. And immediately when you look at this chart and the next one, where we have six different approaches, you would probably start thinking, but cannot this feature be a part of the other approach and vice versa? And often it can. But for our purposes in writing this report, we found it useful to point to these broad distinctions between approaches. Of course, first we point to the experimental approaches as a major category in impact evaluation. And here, within the experimental approaches, we have a randomized control trials as one subcategory. But you can, of course, also do other experiments. You can have your trial group and control group, but you may not select them randomly, for example. You can have a judgmental sample of both random or both control and trial groups. But you can also have quasi-experiments, and there are also natural experiments, and these are all ways of getting to grips with impact. We also have statistical methods as another broad category. You can use statistical modeling, longitudinal studies, etc., to arrive at conclusions around impact. We have the theory-based approaches, which then there are different subcategories of those. But the point there is that your starting point would normally be a theory of change that can be more or less explicit, but which is applied in the design of the intervention itself. And you unpick that in the evaluation process to try to understand the mechanisms whereby the impact is created and whether the assumptions made in the theory of change initially actually holds true. Then we have another three. We have a case-based approaches which tend to be more ethnographic in nature. But I would like to emphasize here that I don't make any distinction here between quantitative and qualitative. All these could actually be either quantitative or qualitative or mixtures of the two. Like, for example, the QCA method, which stands for qualitative comparative analysis, that is actually a quantitative approach within case studies, and it's a way of testing hypotheses on case studies through statistical methods. We have a participatory approaches. There you might argue, is this really a separate category distinct from the others? And you could question whether it's not possible to do either theory-based or case-based or even experimental methods in a participatory way. And I would say, well, probably it is. But you can also identify these as a separate category in their own, because they have another logic to the research process where you primarily validate the program through the participants and their actions rather than by counterfactual logic or through understanding the mechanisms. Then finally, we have synthesis studies, and there are different kinds of synthesis studies as well. But perhaps the important thing here, one important thing is to know about the different approaches and to know that you do have a choice. You also could probably imagine that you can often combine these if you have large evaluation challenges like those projects that I pointed to initially. You would often mix them. And in fact, there is a school in evaluation thinking about mixed methods, which is very common, where you work with all these approaches. But what are our conclusions in this particular study? Well, impact evaluation, and here I read to be sure that every word carries through here. Impact evaluation must fit with contemporary development architecture that is decentralized and works through partnership and where developing countries are expected to be in the lead. And the practical implications of that are that when you work through partners, that leads to multi-stage indirect causal change that impact evaluation has to analyze and has to come to grips with. Most interventions are also contributory causes. They work as part of causal packages in combination with other helping factors, such as stakeholder behavior, related programs and policies, institutional capacities, cultural factors, or socioeconomic trends. And designs and methods for impact evaluation need to be able to unpick those causal packages. An impact evaluation should not be regarded as an everyday commission. Any impact evaluation that is thorough and rigorous will be costly in terms of time and money and will have to be justified. I think that's a message that comes both from Anders' presentation and from mine. That was part one. And I was thinking before I go on to part two, I could probably take one or two questions if you have anything which is burning right now. It is a very complex subject, and I would actually to refer you to the report, probably. Sure.
Had that on that list, or if you include in some of these approaches?
I would expect that that's a mixed method approach where you would find elements of both theory-based and experimental and statistical approaches to unpicking the impact questions. That's a short answer, but if I understand your question correctly, that would be my gut feeling around the Stern report. It's another Stern, by the way, from the Stern who was involved in this one. Okay, then we proceed to the quality of CEDAS evaluations. And here I will actually be referring to four different reports. The most recent one came about a couple of months ago, in fact. It's a midterm review of a framework agreement for CEDAS reviews, evaluations, and advisory service on results frameworks. But the purpose of that midterm review was to look at the contractual arrangements and the organization in CEDAS evaluation system. But as part of what the consulting firm did was they also looked at the quality of evaluation reports. And when they did so, they applied the same method that a team working on CEDAS evaluation, the quality of CEDAS evaluations a couple of years before had applied, and I was leading that team. That report is called OCDA Evaluations Good Enough. And then I'm also going to refer to an article in the peer-reviewed journal Evaluation from 1997, which I wrote together with a colleague, Jerker Karlsson, which is about the quest for quality, or can evaluation findings be trusted? And actually, there is a study from a few years before, from 1994, about aspects on quality of Swedish aid evaluation, which was commissioned by the organization which existed in the early 90s, which was also an independent group for aid evaluations as a committee under the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. I'd just like to mention that in the 1994 study, we looked at 177 different evaluations between 69 and 94. In 97, we had added another 100. And in 2008, we looked at 34 separate evaluations, and in 2013, 80 reports. And as you see, though, that means that we have looked at a couple of 400 reports. This is still a fairly small share, given that CEDA commissions something like 50, 60, maybe even a bit more evaluations a year. It goes up and down. So looking at 20, 30 years, you still have a few thousand reports to, but in some way pronounce on results in aid. What defines quality? Well, we have often started with the program evaluation standards, which set down what constitutes quality in an evaluation. And a good evaluation should be utilizable. Utility is a major factor for quality. It should be feasible, meaning that it should be politically and economically feasible. It should be ethically conducted. Propriety is around ethics in the evaluation process. And it should be accurate, of course. These standards put utility at the top, not by chance, but because they consider that utilization is the most important quality criteria for an evaluation report. But in our assessments, most of the studies here, both the one I led in 2008 and the most recent one, they only focus on accuracy and what you can say about accuracy by looking at the reports themselves. Let me just comment on the choice of evaluation design. We don't really know, but the 2008 report found that at least 33% could be said to be theory-based, but that's generously interpreted. None of them experimental, and it was the same throughout the different years, just to give some flesh to the bones of what Anders said about that. But we would also like to say that the choice of design doesn't immediately reflect on the poor quality of individual evaluations. But in a system where you commission so many evaluation reports, you could say that, well, some variety in approaches would be desirable. So you would expect to see a number of randomized control trials or other experimental methods being applied. You would expect to see a couple of QCA studies or a couple of experimental approaches or so. But by and large, the it's not impact that drives the design of evaluation, because most terms of reference have a number of different questions where impact is one of many, and hence it's not the most appropriate design for impact that drives the overall design of the evaluation. There is also a very low awareness of a choice of design. As I mentioned before, evaluation methods are primarily discussed in terms of data collection. So, what did we find? Well, in 1994, we found that in this categorization of excellent, adequate, and poor, that 6% could be said to be excellent, 45% adequate, and 18% poor, and not possible to assess in quite a number of cases. More or less the same a couple of years later. The aggregated ratings in 2008, we found none in the excellent category, around 11 good, 12 adequate, and 6 with significant shortcomings in some respects and some shortcomings in most of the other, and some significant shortcomings in all aspects of quality. Mind you, in these two later studies, that means in terms of quality criteria that have to do with accuracy. We are not here talking about either utility, propriety, or feasibility of the studies. So it's limited. The most recent rating looks like this, then. They don't have any aggregate rating of all the evaluation reports they look at, but they here distinguish between how good are the terms of reference, how good are the evaluation questions being formulated, how good are the methodologies, what about the data collection and the data analysis and content, the conclusions and recommendations and the reporting, and finally at the very bottom you see an aggregate reporting for it all. And here you also have an average of all the reports we looked at, but they also the most recent ones. And as you can see, this is on a 6-graded scale, so that suggests that if 3 is the benchmark, below 3 it's not satisfactory, above 3 it's okay, then you would find that most are okay, in fact. Now, what can we conclude about quality of evaluations from this? Well, maybe the quality is slowly increasing, and that's a maybe though, because as you see, it is. We actually don't know very much about the quality of evaluations, even though there have been these studies and quite a number of reports being looked at. There are fewer relatively poor evaluations, and that's quite important to increase the benchmark so that you don't have that many failures. We also have fewer really excellent evaluations, but there's more of a centering around the middle and slightly above the middle. Still much confusion about what constitutes quality, and the assessments focus on some few aspects of quality. Ethics and feasibility are those aspects that are most consistently neglected. There have been other studies around the utilization of evaluation findings, and the question of a design for impact assessment has not been properly analyzed in most of the studies that I refer to here. So I don't know if that means that the glass is half full or half empty, but anywhere, it's a question for all of us to ponder about. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much, Kim.